wet, rough beach slouches towards Bethlehem to be born kind of feeling, you know?
An elevator take projection.
Hey, welcome. It's us at Taking It Down, where we give you a new angle at looking at television. Taking It Down is produced by the Alabama Take, a family of podcasts, and a site where you can find essays and articles on television, movies, music, books, sports, and even more. We at Taking It Down are me, I'm Blaine, the editor-in-chief of the Alabama Take. We also have a touring musician and former filmmaker, Adam Morrow. We have our specialist in media at a New England college, Mr. Donovan Reinwald. And we have Natalie Morrow, our resident expert in fantasy, sci-fi, comics, trashy reality TV, and plenty of Beyonce. Each week, this podcast is a short video segment featured on the Alabama Takes YouTube channel, where we open the floor for a little more than TV and streaming at times, or just an added TV segment. It's released each Tuesday evening around 5 p.m. Central. Taking It Down itself is audio only and hits all podcast apps, the website, and YouTube bright and early every Tuesday morning. Subscribe or follow in your favorite podcast app, and you won't miss an episode. Talk to you every Tuesday. Yep, here we are. It's us. We've got Adam. We've got Donovan. We got Natalie. I'll start with a real quick question. We can knock out something here. I'm interested to hear from y'all. I've saved, honestly, for the airwaves. Have you been hearing about Expats from Amazon Prime, starring Nicole Kidman?
Not even a little bit.
No way. No, it's generating buzz, especially with critics. I've seen a lot of headlines saying it's the best show of 2024 so far.
That's only February.
It's only February, but it's based on the book by Janice Y.K. Lee titled The Expatriates. Donovan, are you familiar with this?
I'm not familiar with that.
Yeah, it's pretty popular, two or three years ago, I think.
Okay. I bet if I saw the cover. There's so many books where it's like, yes, blue cover.
Did she also write the very popular book out now called Yellowface?
That's R.F. I'm going to say her last name wrong. R.F. Kang?
Okay, well, I'm sorry to confuse those two, but apparently this was a popular book, and it's supposed to be good. It's on Amazon Prime, Nicole Kidman. I'm not sure how many episodes are out, but I'm debating watching it. I was just curious if y'all had heard of it. I know y'all hadn't watched it.
The only Amazon thing I'm aware of is the Mr. and Mrs. Smith series with Donald Glover, which is really getting deep. Like, I don't know if it's my cup of tea, but I like him. It's getting okay reviews, but I haven't heard about this one at all.
I like him and her, and it.
Oh yeah, she's great too.
I think I probably would have watched it if Phoebe Waller-Bridge would have been. She was initially cast, and if she would have stuck on board as the co-lead, I think I would have watched it. But it's the one thing that turned me off about Mr. and Mrs. Smith is it's not a straight line narrative. It's a week to week.
Mm-hmm.
And so I was like, I want my TV to sort of make me want to tune in every week and not just be like, well, one and done sometimes.
Yeah, it's an older style of TV. Right?
It is. That's something Prestige TV kind of brought to the front. You had to watch every week or you're going to miss something, you know. That was back in the day, you couldn't do that because if you got up and went to the bathroom, you missed a scene and you wouldn't ever see it again unless you caught a rerun in the summer.
Right, yeah, the X-Files has to reset every episode so that you're not too confused, right? Mm-hmm.
And I get it, but hell, I love that TV has turned into chapters of a book, although that's a really dumb way of thinking about it.
I don't think so, because sometimes I almost think that, like, movies are almost like short stories now, and TV shows are like novels.
Yeah, I think that's
both
fair.
Are good, but they're, you know, just the time is so different.
Except for Killers of the Flower Moon, which is War and Peace when it comes to books, apparently, which we still have not watched, by the way. Another series that's on a lot of people's TVs over this weekend, seems like. I've seen a lot of people post about watching it and enjoying it. Masters of the Air, Apple TV+. It is a World War II series from Steven Spielberg and Tom Hanks as producers only. But it continues their run, which started with Band of Brothers in the Pacific. We won't get into a lot of detail at all with this one since it's only Adam and Natalie who've watched the, two episodes?
Three are out, but yeah, we've seen two.
Right, there are three out, and the series made by John Sheban and John Orloff and stars Austin Butler, one of our favorites, Barry Kagan. Plenty more people, obviously, because it's a World War II epic piece. And my first question, obviously, is does the first episode end with Barry Kagan dancing naked through Castle?
It's actually the only thing he does.
Well, there you go. Count me in.
Let's just say the mess hall is quite messy.
Does Barry Kagan fuck a grave of a comrade?
Not yet.
War's early yet.
I say, what about someone he loved, but also might have hated?
No, give me some general thoughts, Natalie. What are you thinking about Masters of the Air? And I'll be honest with you, Natalie, I'm not trying to be rude or mean. It seems like a guy kind of show, or even a dad show. Are you enjoying it?
It's definitely in dad show territory with, like, Tom Hanks as the producer.
I mean, I like all war-based things. Don't most people?
I mean, sometimes.
I love the Bands of Brothers.
Okay.
I think this is a... I don't know. I mean, who knows?
Natalie has a very high tolerance for dad entertainment.
Oh, well, that's cool.
Is it?
No wonder she fits in with us.
Like, you're going to watch The Hunt for Red October tonight.
I had it locked and loaded, ready to say that this household is a moth to a flame of a World War II picture. And same with World War I. And
hey, Adam, rank your wars. Where are we? Because me, it's Vietnam. Then it's... I mean, it is. I'm more of a Vietnam War guy. I think y'all are more of a World War II group.
Oh, man. You give me a sweet Peloponnesian War? Oh, I'd be all over that.
Yeah. A little War of 1812.
Y'all have both seen Band of Brothers.
Yes.
I assume.
And the Pacific. I've watched both of those.
I mean, I know people who... Band of Brothers is like an annual watch for them. It's not just like dudes who grew up watching too much History Channel. It's like people that you would not expect. And I think that they hit on something. So, you know, like the timing of it, there was a great Band of Brothers podcast for the 20th anniversary a few years ago. And they talked to all the actors, and the actors were telling stories about meeting the men that they, a lot of them were fortunate enough to, have met the people that they played, the ones that lived through the war. It was also tied in with, the first episode came out a few days before 9/11 and kind of like positioning, now they're at 20 years on, they're able to look back on that time and the time that they actually created the show in the late 90s when the Greatest Generation was, a lot of them still with us, but starting to depart. And it was just a cool, like, look how many historic moments in American history we were hitting with just this one show. And it was so well done that it just kind of, like, I don't think you have to care about looking at battlefield maps or going to a museum and seeing the different kinds of rifles that were carried or, like, things like that. I think it's just a very human story, and that's what was so good about that one. And the Pacific was so rough by comparison, as it should have been, but it didn't seem to resonate in the same way.
I think it's just not as good as Band of Brothers. Like, Band of Brothers, like you said, like, there's something where it just all clicked. And, like, the Pacific isn't bad, but it's not clicking in the same way.
The Pacific is still, like, a far above average piece of war media. It's just Band of Brothers is, like, maybe the best of our time.
I mean, it's almost like the classic sophomore album problem, right? Like, how do you follow up your...
Yeah, the Genius debut.
Yep.
And now this, you can't help but compare to both of them. And through two episodes, I think it's pretty good. I don't know that it's exceptional yet. I don't know what you think, Nat.
Yeah, I don't think it measures up, and I think everybody wants it to, because it's kind of being advertised in that way. It's good. I'm enjoying it. But the first episode, it's a pretty stark difference between the quality of the writing, the production of, like, that first episode of Band of Brothers is incredible. You understand so much about the relationships of these people, whereas this show kind of, it doesn't quite have that touch. And I don't know, maybe they'll go back and do something, but as of yet, it doesn't measure up in that way.
What do you think of the writing issue, Nat?
Yeah, there was a scene, without going into any detail, this wouldn't be a spoiler anyways, where basically the scene was panning through a building, and everybody was kind of getting ready to go off on their assignment. And the dialogue, the way that the dialogue was set up, felt very much like you were watching a play. So it was like, these people are talking because they're on screen, and then they're going to get quiet. And now these people are talking because they're on screen. It just, it feels a little bit different than Band of Brothers or The Pacific did. Not in it, I'm still enjoying it, but I think the quality is quite a bit different.
The other thing that my brain had to get used to is Band of Brothers forced you to know so many different people. And by the end, you know them all. But that first episode, you're just like, what is happening? Everybody has like roughly the same haircut and clothes too. Yes. So
yeah,
yes. It doesn't.
This one, there's a lot fewer people, it seems like, Natalie.
Yeah.
Or there's still a fair amount, but they're all on screen a lot. And so you kind of pick up on it quicker. But then the pros of the show are, I assume that like the Pacific and Band of Brothers, they have pretty good source material. I haven't looked into what they're basing it on, if they based it on one work like they did with the other two or not. But, you know, like seeing how you imagine what being in a flying fortress plane would be like and like what that life is like. You know, there's still like the glimpse under the hood of, and I'm sure everyone is really, you see these things and you're like, how would I react in that situation? And so you do just want to know, like, how did they find out where they were going to fly? Mm-hmm. What did the day look like when they woke up? And they kind of just go into all of these things that are enough to scratch an itch for me. And Donovan, I thought, we briefly texted about it, but I thought about your grandfather and what your experience would be like watching this dramatization of something that he lived through.
Yeah, like, it's not a great movie, but the movie Memphis Belle, I kind of have a soft spot for, just because it reminds me of him. And same kind of thing, right? Like, he was, my grandpa was a bomber pilot. He was stationed out of England. I think he was 20 when D-Day happened. So he was like 19 and 20, or 20, and in charge of this whole plane of guys. And like, he has stories about like he was in charge, right? Like, he's got one story where like there were rumors that like the Germans were using shot down bombers and putting them back together and sending them to infiltrate. Obviously no such thing, but you know, it's wartime, there's a rumor. So he's telling one time another bomber came up alongside them and had the guns pointed at their bomber, and they wouldn't answer on the radio. And the guys were like, sir, what do we do? And he's like, I didn't know what to do. So I said, well, point our guns at them. And and then they noticed, and it's like something was wrong with their radio apparently, but they moved their guns, and you know, but it's like that, you know, you're 19 and everyone's like, what do we do?
Yeah, life and death stuff.
Yeah.
Bringing up age, it almost seems like they intentionally cast a lot of baby-faced guys in this. There's like a handful of characters especially where it's like, man, those are children
mm-hmm.
doing this. And they're people who, you know, they didn't even like fly commercial before this. They had just an intellectual concept of what a plane was, and all of a sudden they're like the ones flying it.
Right.
Which is just crazy. Imagine.
Yeah, my grandpa was a cowboy from South Dakota before he went to, I think, Missouri, got pilot training, ended up in England.
Just like that, huh?
Yeah.
Do you remember like who he was with, what division or what?
I've got it written down somewhere. The place in England where the unit was based has a little museum there, and before they were all too old and too gone, they invited a lot of the guys back there probably like 10-15 years ago. So I have a lot of it written down, but off the top of my head I can't remember.
Just wonder how, if this is in the neighborhood or not, because they'll mention other groups that they'll be flying alongside, you know. So I mean, it's his story. It's
yeah.
Pretty great.
One complaint I've seen from a noted critic, Alan Sepinwall, is that he thought it was a fine show, other than it had a big problem with too much of the big story or the big moments that he wanted to see or hear about happen off screen. Have you encountered that at all?
I don't think so. We've only been in the air twice.
Oh.
I do kind of wonder, I'm sure that this will change. You know, the nature of the other shows, you know a lot of where they're going to be. And you kind of, like, when they're, to use the phrase, when they're in the shit, they're in the shit for a while. And these guys in the planes are usually taking off from England and coming back to England. And I know that that won't always be true, but the first two kind of had, like, more of the normal structure of a show than the Pacific and Band of Brothers did. And that, like, there's some drama on base, and then they go fly their mission, and it goes well or it doesn't, and they come back and like decompress from that. And so it's a change from, you know, what we talk about with episodic shows versus like serialized, I guess would be the word, right? That everything has to be kind of contained. It almost feels, it's obviously not, but that format's different. Donovan, correct me on this if I'm wrong, but as the war progresses, things got a little bit easier if you were flying a plane, because there was less defense left from the Germans.
Yeah, and the Luftwaffe, like, I think it was, I don't know, don't quote me on this. I think shortly after D-Day, the Luftwaffe completely lost any kind of air superiority. It was American air superiority from that point on. So you didn't have as many, right, like, you didn't have, I mean, it was still dangerous, obviously. But you didn't have as many fighters and stuff like that after you.
Right, so, like, when the 101st is in the Battle of the Bulge, the skies are a little safer place yeah. to be than...
Agree. Yeah, yeah, exactly. And in fact, like, even, right, like, the 101st in the Battle of the Bulge, like, part of the Battle of the Bulge is that America has air superiority at that point.
Right.
And the Germans don't.
Battle of the Bulge also, it's interesting to note that that was the name of the final scene of Saltburn.
It all ties together. But yeah, it's a pretty good show.
Pretty good.
I know we didn't want to spend a ton of time on this, and we kind of talked for too long on it. But
my barber shop they did a little Photoshop and put all four of their barbers in the poster and wrote "Masters of Hair."
I like that.
So apparently they were watching it a lot in the barbershop, but at home, each of them were.
Some dads doing a dad show joke in a very dad place.
Yeah, yes. Man, it just hit. So that, yeah, that's what we got on Masters of Air. What do you think, Adam? Obviously, Donovan would love it. Where would you think I'd land on this?
Where? How do you feel about Band of Brothers?
I'm scared of getting canceled if I tell you my real opinion. No, I thought it was fine. I didn't love it, but I thought it was fine.
How do you feel about playing the remote control volume during a show? You got to ride that volume control.
No, I don't like doing that either. Am I not?
No.
Don't watch the show then.
Okay.
What about Band of Brothers was just so to you?
I think it goes back to it felt a little too episodic than serialized was one big thing. And what you mentioned earlier about I couldn't quite keep up with some of them at the time for whatever reason. I may have watched it during a distracted time of my life.
Oh, I definitely have faith. Like, I can solidly tell you who Dick Winters is and everyone else. It's like you have the same haircut, you have the same dirty face, you have the same uniform.
Well, don't forget Jimmy Fallon.
Oh, yeah, that's right.
Jimmy Fallon, the one supply run that he did.
Yeah. Yes, I forgot about that. And of course, I can tell Ross. You know,
Of course.
From Friends.
Yeah, kind of hard to see him in that role, too, after you watch Friends so much.
Yeah, he does a good job, I thought, because he just kind of...
I kind of wondered if your complaint about it would be that, you know, even celebrating the Greatest Generation, which is like something that Tom Hanks and Steven Spielberg would just say they were doing, is already like buying into the fact that they are the Greatest Generation. Right. And that there's some, like, obviously defeating Nazis, every thumb up that's possible to give. Good job, guys. A lot of heroics. But there's some, like, American exceptionalism just inherent in that kind of storytelling that I know grates people.
That never bothered me. But I think the biggest complaint I could make off the top of my head without thinking about it too deeply beforehand is that it felt like a story about a war and not a story about any one or two or three particular people, maybe.
Mm.
Hmm.
And that's fine, too. If you kind of want, I should go back to it and take that approach. And I think I probably would like it a lot.
I feel like it's very much about those dudes.
Yeah, but I just never felt like I could attach to any three of them.
Hmm.
Now, it's been years since I've tried to watch it. Years.
Yeah. I've seen it enough times to, like, know who they are
right.
in the first episode, too, which helps. But, yeah, I mean, there's even some of that exceptionalism in, you know, I mean, obviously the book that Band of Brothers is based on, sometimes you're like, did an academic come through this before it was published? A lot of it's just, like, good stories, you know.
The answer is definitely no.
Right. And this one, there's little moments like they're drinking with some guys from the Royal Air Force who are very, like, you know, have the posh accents, the upper class British accents, and just kind of grate the American airmen to the point that a challenge is thrown down and a fist fight breaks out. And of course, the British gentleman is dispatched pretty easily.
Is this a la Lane Price and Pete Campbell?
Well, Lane won that one, didn't he?
I think he did. I think he did.
He kicked his ass.
And even
well,
this
he
one,
his nose.
Yeah.
The way that he wins is he playfully, mockingly dodges the British guy's punches and then just clobbers him in the face, right, Nat? It's kind of like, oh, Gus, we're the tough guys.
I mean, it definitely looked like, because it's Barry, it's our friend Barry who's in the fist fight. It looks like he dodges a punch and then just claps the guy on the back of the head, and the guy just goes down and is out. It was a very cheesy fight scene.
Yeah, very like, look at these tough guy. Either New Yorkers or like cowboys. You know what I mean?
If you ever want the opposite of that, I can strongly recommend the movie A Matter of Life and Death, because one of the through, it takes place with there's English bomber pilots and American crews, and the through line of just like the Americans are a bunch of hee-haws is great.
Yeah.
Can't recommend it enough.
There you go, Masters of Air. Is it Masters of the Air, or is it just Masters of Air, right?
I think the air. We're all Masters of Air, so we're not.
Yeah, we are. We take it in quite well. Before Adam and Natalie leave, I want you in on this. Donovan has been sucking down episode after episode of Bluey. Very interested to hear. Now, so have I, but not by choice. But Donovan, you don't have kids.
No kids.
Just watching the 8-minute episodes of Bluey, just crushing tape on Bluey.
It's great.
Crushing tape.
What do we think about Bluey? Because I do like it. If I'm going to watch a kids show at all, any of them almost, I want Bluey.
Yeah.
I think it's a great program.
Natalie, are you a fan?
I mean, I don't watch it, but the few times that I've seen it, I'm like, oh, I get it. This is great. This is better than any of the other crap that's on TV for kids.
Oh, yeah. It's got some very funny moments and some very sentimental moments that'll jerk a tear out of your eye.
I just love how it's basically about two kids doing their best to ruin their parents' lives.
That's reality.
That's why I think it's accurate.
The dad cracks me up quite a bit. It's a realistic kind of dad, I suppose. He does put me to shame how he's always willing to play with his kids, though.
Well, he grouses a little bit.
He does, and I can relate. Unihorse is my favorite episode. Whenever the Unihorse comes on.
Yes.
Yeah. So, and my daughter has a thing where she will come to me and says, "You want the horn? Because you're getting the horn." And she'll butt you in the head.
Do you guys do the thing where you try and look for a long dog in every episode?
No.
Oh, yeah.
Uh-uh. Say more. Well, I will now. What am I
it's
looking for?
Apparently, it's a thing where in every single episode, there's a hidden long dog.
Okay.
And you just have to like find it. And like there are adult fan clubs on the internet who like post their weekly long dog sighting.
Okay. That's fun.
It's fun.
Do what you do, people of the internet.
I mean, that's getting uncomfortably close to Disney adult, really.
Yeah, it is.
Well, I was thinking the are they called bronies?
Oh, yeah. That was a thing, wasn't it?
I think
there was
it's an still
episode of Bob's Burgers about
is
that.
A thing.
Is that still going on? They haven't. Sometimes I hear about stuff like that, and I think about this one King of the Hill episode where Hank's like, "They haven't bullied that out of you yet, Bobby."
No, we don't do bullying anymore, and that's the problem with everything.
How can we shame without bullying?
Right. That needs to happen.
Yeah, it's very discipline and punish.
The difference in poison and medicine here.
Right, exactly. You want a little medicine.
Right.
Well, that brings us to our sponsor for the week, which is Disney Swingers. Right.
I thought we were sponsored by Big Bullying.
Big Bullying Company. Yes. All right. Well, we're going to take a very short break here. And we're going to bid adieu to Adam and Natalie. And Donovan and I are going to be on the other side to talk True Detective Part 2. No, 3. Part 3.
We're halfway through.
Ooh, big deal. All right. So stick with us. Little music interlude. And we'll be back.
I'm going to scat.
True Detective Night Country Part 3 is where we are. If you haven't seen that far, then don't listen yet. Come back, because we're going to just dive right into it and spoil everything that's happening in Ennis, Alaska that we know so far, which we're at the halfway point, Part 3. There are only 6 episodes. You probably know the details. I won't break it down anymore. Donovan, what's that epigraph? I'm sure you've got it memorized now.
I don't have it memorized. And it's almost something like out of Nietzsche, isn't it?
No, it's based off of the...
No, sorry. I meant It almost sounds like something Nietzsche would write. It's been kind of rattling through my brain ever since they showed it. Yeah, I'm going to call him Robert Howard. God bless me. He wrote Conan. The King in Yellow. The writer of The King in Yellow.
Yeah, and it's from his, I think, narrator from that story. Hildred Castagnier?
Yeah, something like that.
She says, "For we do not know what beast the night dreams when its hours grow too long for even God to be awake."
It's a good little spine chiller.
Ooh, good. Yeah, for sure. Good quote. Yeah, let's start with my dumbest question first. Since this season does seem to be leaning into the supernatural, obviously with Fiona Shaw's Rose in the very first episode talking to a dead lover on the screen, mm-hmm. not off screen, it's on screen, does that negate or contradict or retcon the end of the first season at all?
The end of the very first season of True Detective.
Where it seems to be they wash their hands of anything supernatural or mystical. And this one is like, nope, it's on the screen. Here you are. What do you think?
Well, I mean, we'll see what happens, right, mm-hmm. by the end mm-hmm. of this show. But, you know, to me, honestly, it's not a sequel. It's a related series. And it's picking up stuff from season one that I liked. And frankly, so far, it's sticking in a direction that I wish season one had. I did like the cosmic horror supernatural element, and I like that this one's sticking with it. I don't think it like negates or rewrites, because in my mind they are two different things. I think that's the great thing about if HBO were to make the choice to do this going forward as sort of an anthology series with different folks getting a chance to explore whatever. Mm-hmm. I think that would work for me.
Yeah, it works for me. I do. This episode felt a smidge too overt with the supernatural, with the last scene.
Man, I ate it up.
Yeah, I ate it up. Don't get me wrong.
I think I agree with you, though.
But it just felt a little too Stephen King. Remember that show, mm-hmm. The Outsider, that we watched and covered from HBO? Mm-hmm. Yeah, it felt more at home there than it did with True Detective. But now, I will say this. We're diving in the last scene early. That's fine. Navarro could very well be simply seeing shit like her sister and her mom.
Yes.
And that would be killer. And we're just privy to it because we're connected to her character.
I mean, we get, you know, the second episode, right? Don't confuse the spirit world with mental illness.
Exactly. You know, it said it. So, wow, if they do that.
At least the woman who knows in her heart, right, that she's connected to the spirit world, hears about Navarro's sister and thinks that it's mental illness.
Mm-hmm. Well, back up. Worth a note that the birthing scene to open this week featured a woman screaming, and the last scene featured a lot of women and others screaming.
Yes.
Opening and ending. I thought it was interesting, too, and worth noting that opening scene with the lady giving birth had no father or men at all in the scene. Mm. And it was just a little nudge at us as viewers to say that this is a largely a story of women.
Oh, yeah, definitely. And, I mean, I don't want to lay out absolute trait, but, like, what's more woman, especially throughout, you know, history with the association, what's more woman of a woman than giving birth, right? And mm-hmm. being there at a birth and shepherding a baby into the world, however you do that. And then, yeah, the screaming at the end gave me a very, because we have the birth screaming, which, you know, that all ends up fine, right? The baby lives.
Horrific for a second, but fine.
It's a good, I really thought we were going to get, yeah, but at the end, the screaming, it gave me a very, like, you know, what rough beach slouches towards Bethlehem to be born kind of feeling, you know?
Very much. They really want to play up Hank being a possible suspect with the racist pals coming in to help search for the missing scientist.
His hillbilly friends.
Now, the question remains is, again, we're starting at the beginning to go to the end. So he's got these racist pals coming up to help search for the missing lab scientist. And then they're in the hospital in the final scene. Why? Why are they there? Did he send them there to cause a ruckus?
It is not clear, right? Because all we see is there's the down the hall, right?
Mm-hmm.
There's the noise coming up, and then you know, the doctors or nurses are like, "Hey, we need help." And we get there, and there's a fight that's broken out, but we have no idea why or what's going on.
But it's those guys.
It is those guys. Yeah, it is those guys. But we don't know why we're there. We don't know why they're there. We don't know what they're fighting over. We don't know anything yet.
John Hawks, Hank, does say to Navarro, she tells him, we got to find this scientist alive. And he says, do we?
Yeah.
You know, they really want you to think, oh, he's behind something.
Yeah, he's implicated.
Got a big kick. You know, we've lauded Jodie Foster over and over these last couple of weeks, but I got such a big kick out of her delivery of this every subsequent line from Liz after Pete asked, I thought you hated everyone. And she says, so matter-of-factly, I do. Hate everyone.
Yeah.
Hate you.
I hate you.
I love that line. I could watch her deliver those kinds of semi-hateful lines all day.
It's something about the very clipped voice, the very clipped matter-of-fact voice that
she's got it.
Yeah, I mean, I know we've been saying, to those of you who may or may not have listened to the now three episodes in a row, you're probably tired of hearing about Jodie Foster, but daggum, apparently good actors are good actors. Who knew? Uh-huh.
You know? But here's the thing. It's also, there's a component of writing in here. Nobody, I don't think anybody could do this but Jodie Foster, but the component of writing that's worthy of praise is they give Liz the same characteristics that don't bother us with jaded and tortured male protagonists. And, you know, just to see, all right, can you handle a woman doing this?
Yeah.
You know, it's a nice, maybe overt touch. You know, she's on Tinder. She dates married men. But, you know, she does have a way with kids, grown-up kids.
Yes, she does.
Or small kids. And I just find that all a package of good characterization.
Yeah, I agree with you, Blaine. I really, and like part of it too is like, it's almost doing the thing Mad Men did, right? Where it's like, we can pile this unlikable stuff onto John Hamm because he's so charismatic and his character is so interesting, you're going to keep watching. Don Draper can be a little, I wouldn't call him a monster, although he can be a little monstrous. I don't think she's quite at that level, but I do think that there is, I don't know, this may just be speculation, but like a comfort with letting the character be really, really rough around the edges in a way a male protagonist would, because Jodie Foster is shepherding the character along so well.
I almost made the comparison to Don Draper as well. So it's got some aspects of that. The women in town certainly hate her.
They do not care for officer or chief Dammers.
And some of the men don't like her.
Some of everyone doesn't, you know. Yeah. Nobody really seems to like her that much, except what they said, Pete, right? He's like, you're the only one who likes her. I also did, that reminds me too, this is jumping out a little bit, but I did enjoy the scene where Hank is like, you trying to Mrs. Robinson, my son?
Uh-huh.
And she hits the water or whatever it is.
It's coffee.
His face. Coffee, that's right.
Yeah.
And Hank's like, who's Mrs. Robinson? Or not Hank. Pete's like, who's Mrs. Robinson?
Yeah, he didn't get the reference.
This is good. That was good.
And then that happens all the time, trust me.
That was good.
People that age. Yeah.
Yes. Yeah, then why would he know?
We get a flashback, a couple of them. This time it's Navarro and Chief Danvers before she was chief.
Yep.
We get their last case together. They go to some sort of house or trailer where a guy has murdered his wife. It's a domestic abuse continuation, and he's sadly, like a lot of that stuff ends, he's murdered her, and they called it a murder suicide, but the flashback we see has them coming in on the guy and he's still alive, and we never see what happens.
We never see a yes,
and we just know Navarro hates her after that and won't work with her, and she goes on to become a trooper instead of a police.
And it could be right that, like, okay, we assume, okay, the guy shoots himself right after this, right? But so, and maybe that's what it's going to be, but kind of like the fight in the hospital. We don't have any information yet. It's still open.
It's so good. I love the ambiguity they're playing with here. What do you think? Did Navarro kill the guy? Because she's super into being protective against women who have, you know, domestic problems. We've already seen that side of her.
So I don't know how cute the writing wants me to think about it, but I do believe that, yeah, like we're supposed to at least consider the possibility, right?
Mm-hmm.
That she killed him.
Yeah.
Killed the murderer.
Yeah, which makes you think, why would Navarro be mad at Liz because of that?
Well, Liz says she don't ever want to work with her either.
That's true.
You know, there's some kind of terrible break there. Both, neither of them really like the other at this point.
It's a trope to have detectives drinking coffee constantly, but
yeah.
Have you ever...
I get it. It's dark all the time.
I was about to say, have you ever read the effects of living that far north and experiencing night for so long?
Yeah.
What's it like? What does that do?
So my not quite up as far north as this, but my brother Alex was, he's in the National Guard. He's a major in the National Guard, but when he was a lieutenant, he was posted up to Fairbanks, Alaska, which I think is about 100 miles from where this is supposed to take place.
Mm-hmm.
100 miles south, maybe. So it gets pretty dark.
Yeah.
And, you know, we kind of asked that, you know, what do you do? You know, and they like, but it kind of got all, for me, it was summed up in my brother and sister-in-law's faces where people would be like, how do you like Alaska? And they'd get these kind of pained smiles on and be like, the summers are nice.
Huh.
It's cold. It's dark. There's nothing, right? Like he was talking about living in Fairbanks. Like, you know, there really is that, like, there's nothing to do but drink. There are people who will, you know, because like there's homeless folks, right? So they'll try and get picked up by the police so they don't freeze to death outside. I mean, I don't think it's like horrible, right? Like there's a lot of good stuff and cool stuff too. But like if you want to feel bleak about something, I think there's plenty to feel bleak about.
I always wanted to try something like that for maybe about 8 months or a year, just to try it.
See if you could handle it.
Yeah, I'm interested.
Yeah.
I don't know if it's a slot on the show or it's writing, but there wasn't a follow-up about the trailer and its contents from the end of part two.
My assumption is we're going to see more of that later.
Surely. It seemed really odd. You're talking about that effigy, which almost looked like a real body. I thought it might be a dead body, but it was not.
I think it's a little like scarecrow type thing.
Right.
I assume that's coming in later, too. So the only thing, and we'll see, right? But they were at least good with like, okay, episode two, the corpse wakes up, but we don't really see anything more of them, right? Mm-hmm. Like, all we know, okay, is in the hospital, and then it comes back in here. So it's like, you know, at least, I mean, we'll see what happens over six episodes, but at least so far, it hasn't seemed like they've just, like, dropped a thread.
Mm-hmm.
You know, who knows? It could go any number of ways still.
Yeah. There's significance for Navarro not knowing her own Inuit name.
Yeah, that was sad.
It kind of was. Now, apparently,
I felt like that was sad. Or that made me sad, I guess.
No, I think that's correct.
The way I felt, yeah.
She had lived in Boston because her mom moved away from the area and some domestic troubles there, which makes sense on why she's so protective. But she never learned from her mom her Inuit name. That, in their culture, serves as a protection. It's like a driver's license for her to be recognized by her ancestors if she ever goes to the spirit world, or maybe even after you die, you've got that name and they're there for you, they know you, they'll protect you. Then you have the, just after being sedated, Lun comes up out of the bed, Stephen King moment for the show. And he says it's
practically a, you know, exorcist moment, right? Your mother sucks cocks in hell or whatever is, you know.
And
that's what it reminded me of.
Yes.
Because, you know, with the reference to her mother.
Yeah, he says that her mom's waiting for her.
Which, to me, also does a good job of calling back to the conversation about what the dead want, right?
Mm-hmm. Yes.
And that's a discussion Navarro has had, you know?
Yeah.
It was creepy. It worked for me.
Yeah.
And I think part of it too was like just the horrific nature of the medical injuries make the sudden calm and all the more horrific.
Yeah, there's, you could chalk it up to supernatural. You could say that the show's leaning too heavily into that. You could also say that, hey, medicine does weird shit to people. That somebody raising up and saying something really offbeat and then passing out is not unusual after sedation.
I think that the show so far, maybe the thumb's a little bit on the supernatural, but honestly, so far, as a viewer, I don't think it's coming down one way or the other, right? Because we got, like, it almost seems supernatural in the first one. And then in the second one, we get a lot of, like, concrete, real-world evidence, right? And it's, like, evidence that's pulled up by, like, actual police work, right? By, like, looking at the credit card, tracking the you know, like, a person did something, and police officers are able to, or investigators are able to uncover what that person did. And then we, obviously, we have the ending of this episode. So I do think it's kind of seesawed nicely for me. It hasn't come down too hard one side or the other. I wouldn't be disappointed if the supernatural, if the weird aspects of it were there, but I think it's so far done a very nice balancing act, I guess is you could say.
The only thing that points to, no, we're 100% supernatural would be that Rose incident of talking to a dead lover. Now, how much is that is her being high and thinking that's what she sees? You know, that certainly could be played that way. I'm telling you, if Navarro just thinks she saw the guy raise up and say something like that because she's got the mental issues throughout her family, it's genetic, that's even scarier to me than maybe him rising up as a, whatever you want to say, possessed human. We do have the one small through line I'll mention before we wrap. It's that the mind is destroying nature in a way, yes. And that seems to be what's stirring up all this ancient horror, perhaps.
It's getting into the water.
Mm-hmm.
People have obviously been killed because of it. It's contentious, right?
Mm-hmm. Danvers finally sees it.
Yeah, the town ceases to exist as it currently is, if the mind ceases to be. Now, whether that's a good thing or a bad thing, I think different characters in the show, you know, the cops at least would be like, well, this would be bad. There'd be no money. I think some of the activists would say, like, you know what, we can imagine a different future. We can imagine a different way forward. We just have to be creative. But I think that's kind of an interesting, I mean, it's not like unique, but it's thematically working for me.
Yeah, me too. It's reminiscent of places like Alabama that we have, where if you shut the mines down, people are going to be out of work. You got to provide some other training or jobs. And how long is that going to take before they get hired again? How many people are going to spiral into poverty, but at the same time, you're killing the planet? I mean, it's just...
Yeah. I mean, that's a great point, Blaine. Right? It's like the coal mines in Alabama, right? Where you have people who... Right, yeah, like they depend on those jobs, but then, you know, you have folks that are people do get killed, it's dangerous, but just it's so hard on your body, right? Mm. And it's bad for the environment. Yet the way things are set up for most of the folks in it, and I'm sure I'd be the same way if I was a miner, you know, it's the best bad alternative is to keep on as it is.
Yeah. Because providing training or new jobs, going green, making solar panels, that's not going to happen overnight.
Right, and like you said, if you give me that, you know, a bird in the hand or two in the bush, right? If you give me the potential future job or my current certain job, most people, myself included, are going to take the sure thing.
Yeah, trust me. I know.
Yeah.
Not to that extreme, but I'm there. You know, I get it. There we are. Can't wait to see more.
It's coming on tonight. Recording night, I mean.
Yeah. We record on Sunday, so we always get excited to talk about it right before we get to maybe watch it tonight or soon. That's the end of our podcast, the audio. Now, don't forget, there's a more lighthearted, more fun, the challenge-based segment of our podcast. It's video only. It's on YouTube. Go to the Alabama Take. You can find a link there to YouTube. Go to YouTube and search the Alabama Take, and you'll find our Taking It Down video segment each week. Around 5 p.m. on Tuesday afternoons. And thanks for joining us each Tuesday. If you like us, let us know. Let us know who you are. We appreciate everyone listening. And adios.